This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
I was always a kid who was writing and singing and performing, and I did my first semi-pro musical show when I was 15, so started pretty young.
Oh, how did you get involved with that kind of thing?
I think what happened was, I think it was a musical production of Aladdin. And what just happened was I was always singing these Disney songs. And I think my parents attended me to the fact that there was an audition going on. I went in and surprisingly got the part of Aladdin. And the rest kind of, you know, it was kind of a snowball effect ever since.
Oh, wow. So it was just like your parents' forethought to like bring you to the audition? That's so nice of them.
I think my father was a musician, and I think he understood
awesome.
That for me it was almost a necessity to express myself in that way. So he figured, why not do that on an actual stage?
Yeah. No, it's awesome. Believe me, I love it. I teach some kids, and I always am like, you know, it's so great that their parents are like letting them do this kind of thing. Because there's lots of people in the world whose parents are like, no. So it's great when your parents are supportive.
Yeah, and I mean, it's even more lucky when your father or even any of your parents themselves have been on stage and know what it's like. And so it's been very easy for them to have empathy for that situation.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Man, that must be fun. Have you then seen, so you've seen your father like perform on stage then?
Oh, absolutely. And I was lucky enough to even share the stage with him once in a musical production from The Last 5 Years. You know that? Jason Robert Brown?
No. Wow. Awesome. That's so great. I love that you guys got to perform together. That's super awesome. I would love that. Tell me more about the other shows that you have done in your childhood. Did you then get involved with the local theater and you were, you know, just doing a bunch of stuff after that?
I had a weird trajectory because I started off with a musical and then I got into kind of what I guess what you would call youth theater school, which also was a part full-time program. And it was very prestigious, this thing. And yet I felt kind of unhappy because I was attracted more to being an entertainer, I guess, than I was to being a very serious thespian. And I did a bunch
I think
of,
there's a place for both.
So, yeah, and I did a bunch of, you know, I did some rock operas. I did Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah,
I did The Last 5 Years. Did some stuff with Rent, these kinds of local productions. And the weird thing that happened was that I was kind of disillusioned with professional theater for a while, or at least making my money. And just and I decided to go to university instead. I did a year at music school professionally. And I went to university to study, believe it or not, American studies. So something that had nothing to do with theater. And then I got involved with this local little theater, English theater club. It was called Get. From those theater rehearsals that we always had, you know, very classically, first 15, 20 minutes, we would improvise and for fun. And after a couple of years, someone went, you know, maybe we should just do a show where we just do improv. And, you know, fast forward 12, 13 years later, and now we do this all the time. So it's
always the same group.
Yeah, well, I mean, members come and members go, but essentially the same foundation, yeah. And it went from this little kind of university project to something kind of massive, and that's great. But just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. So,
yeah. What university did you go to?
I come from a place called Groningen in English, I guess. And I went to the University of Groningen. The Netherlands has this peculiar setup where I think a lot of people internationally think of they say Holland, right? So they think of Amsterdam and Rotterdam and places like that. And what Holland actually is Holland is our two western provinces, North Holland and South Holland. And Groningen is all the way to the north. I say all the way. It's 2 hours by train because Netherlands is very tiny. And in that town, it's a very international, very big student city. And so that's where I went to university, and that's where a very unlikely place to start from, but that's where we started.
Hmm. So you, after you did this program in college, what was the journey for you after that? How did you find your next opportunities? Did you start acting in films, or did you stay focused on improv and theater?
A couple of things happened at the same time. I did have some, for example, some big auditions out west with some, you know, famous Dutch stars and all that. But I was just having so much more fun with improv, and it was getting bigger and bigger. And I, even when I was still a student myself, I already started teaching improv on the regular, like every week, and the group kept growing. First you get 10 students, then you get 30, then you get 50, you know. And so by the time that I graduated, that ball was already rolling, partially. And I just had to invest more time and energy into, you know, making, you know, you got to make some money, into making more money from it, whatever, you're not, and just doing more and more shows.
Yeah. So how did you make money?
Yeah, so I guess part of it is always luck, isn't it? It's always a combination of luck and just investing your time and energy wisely.
Yeah.
The time and energy was just the fact that I found something that I loved very dearly, which in this case was improvisational comedy. So I loved it so much I wanted to share it, and we kind of wanted to create a community around it. So I started teaching it, and I found that I loved teaching it. And people liked being taught it by myself and my colleague, a man called Kees de Vries. And more and more people showed up. And before we knew it, we had to, you know, have a limit on the classes because it was just too much and there were too many classes and we couldn't even fit it anymore. And so suddenly we started making decent money with it. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, classes can certainly do that. That's great. That's an interesting model. So you guys sort of by default ended up running this theater, like it just grew and grew on you. How has that been? I mean, are you still running this? This is the same group that you're running right now?
Yeah, it's a really weird system because what happened was there was this improv group. So Groningen by itself, here's the thing about Groningen. Groningen is an interesting city. For example, it's the dominoes capital of Europe.
Oh,
so like there
wow.
are no more dominoes per person than right here in Groningen in all of Europe. It's weird, right? And the
it's
reason
fun.
For that is it's incredibly, as I said, very, very big international student city, and also just international in general, like where you have IBM, we have Shell, you know, things like that, Google. And this is the same reason that companies like Domino's would ever showed up. They realized what kind of population was thriving here. There was one improv group before we showed up, they quit, and then we realized that there was no one doing what we were doing. And all of a sudden, every show was either sold out, or if it was a free jam, it was completely full every week. And we realized we were onto something. Now, interestingly enough, the other improv groups that exist within our city, and there are several, all consist of people that we trained. So you create your own competition.
Yeah. I mean, certainly. In the end, I suppose that's probably better, like to have a larger community with lots of different possible styles, you know?
Oh. Absolutely. And we try to support each other. We all show up at each other's shows. And the craziest part is that all these shows are full. So that just goes to show that there's a huge audience and a huge need for that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I have certainly heard of the Netherlands love for improv with a few of my friends here in Austin who went to Boom Chicago in Amsterdam. I was like, what? It is hugely popular? They're like, yeah, it's a big deal. And I'm like, what? Really?
Boom is wonderful. Yeah.
Like, who likes improv? You know what I mean? Like, sometimes I feel like it's pulling teeth to get people to shows here sometimes. And there is a lot of improv. So it's interesting that I'm excited that there's people that are just like ravenous for it. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's crazy. But anyway, so that's the luck part that I was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, just those audiences existing for shows, and the students, the people that want to be students to learn it, the fact that that crowd is there, that's the luck part. Yeah. The investment part, of course, came automatically because we play every single week. We rehearse every single week. I teach every single week, and I've been doing that for a decade. But that is because I'm so passionate about it and because I love it. And so it doesn't really feel like work, even though sometimes the hours are pretty long.
Yeah. I like this theory, the luck and investment, both the things you need to keep it going. That's really smart.
Yeah. And I don't even know if it's luck per se. It's lucky that we arrived at the moment that we did. And then we saw the opportunity and then took that opportunity. So it's also recognizing the luck, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, season. Sure. I mean, there's certainly, we could talk all day about the difference between, well, I worked hard, so it's not luck. But it's like, yeah, sure. But if you think about all the people that are trying to do theater or trying to do improv or trying to be an actor, and they're trying and trying and trying, and that there's like 1% of them that actually like get into movies that a larger community see, then I would call that luck. Like it's not like so they true. Turned out they were the best ones. I've met a lot of them. They're not the best ones.
And vice versa. Some of these people that never make it are some of the most brilliant players you've ever seen. You're like, how did you not make it? Mm-hmm. And it's because they weren't there at the right time in the right place. You know, they have the time, they have the skill, and then sometimes it just doesn't work out. But I feel that the solution there is that what you really need to do first and foremost is to enjoy the process so much that ultimately for you personally, happiness isn't dependent on whether you made it or not, but whether or not you're having a great time as you're doing it.
Yeah, my theory on making it is actually not even that you get $1 million for something that you're doing, but rather that, you know, you continue to do it. So like the 80-year-old guy who's still acting in the community theater production of Oklahoma is the best guy because he's continued to do it despite the fact that everyone was like, maybe you should give it up. Maybe you should be an accountant. Maybe you should stop doing this. Why are you still doing this for 80 years? So it's like, you know, some of us make it 30, 40, 50 years before they're like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. You know, and I see it even now, like I'm in my 40s and there's definitely a part of my generation that is like thrown in the towel. And I'm like, okay, cool. But I'm going to keep going. I want to be doing it. And that to me is making it, is sort of the, like you said, the investment, the doing it, the making it happen.
And it's so much easier if you have true passion for whatever it is you do. I mean, this happens to be improv, but it can translate into basically anything that if you really feel as you're doing it, that, you know, you have a rehearsal and sometimes you're tired and you're like, I don't want to go to rehearsal, but you show up anyway because that's your job. You get paid for that. And then as soon as the rehearsal starts, it's fun again because there's something about that process that you're passionate about that just makes it easy. It's like a good relationship, you know.
Yeah.
Should not be too much.
Yeah, and you're right about like any career. Like it's not even, I mean, we're talking about our specific creative career, but you're right. Like if you're a scientist, I'm sure there's some ups and downs for sure. But like if you are really working towards something that you really are like excited about figuring out and revealing to the world, and this is going to be some really amazing science, then like, yeah, that matters. Like even if it takes 50 years for people to find out versus 20 years, like the work that you put in matters every day.
Yeah. As long as your values or interests connect with what you're doing, that's like half of the work. But I also feel that, you know, the trap is that people, let's say you're a new improviser, let's say that. And you're like, oh, I really want any stage, a small stage is good enough. 50 people in the crowd, that's fine. You know, and that'll make me happy. And the thing is, you get used to that very quickly, and then you get used to 100, and then you get used to 1,000. The thing is that if that's what you're looking for, if that's what you're hunting for, the big crowd, then it won't bring you permanent satisfaction unless what you do is the great part for you. If that's the fun, if that's the party.
Yeah. You know what? I feel like that's a thing that happens to all of us, though, that idea of like more, 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 like what's the next step? What's the next step? What can I do next? And it's like, enjoy where you're at, first of all, but also like the idea that, you know, you don't have to, I don't know, focus so much on this outside of you goal. Like, you're doing it. You're doing it right now. And yeah, it's great that you've achieved this goal and you want to get another goal to move forward to. Yeah, you've done 50 people in an audience. You'd like to have 100. That's good. But it's when it becomes like, you know, sort of sick and pathetic, desperately needing like something from the audience. Why aren't they laughing when they should be laughing? It's like, all right, relax.
You get used to anything, right? Yeah. You get used to anything. So if that's the goal, then you always have to keep it moving. And, you know, it can be great. You know, setting goals for yourself can be an awesome thing. But if that's the only thing you're doing, it can almost become like a disease, you know, at some point. Like, when is enough enough? Mm. Like, at the point where I played my first really big rooms, let's say, like, you know, whatever, 1,000, 1,500 people, I thought, this is great. It doesn't ever need to get I would like to play these shows more often, but it doesn't need to get bigger than this. This is great. You know, I could do this forever.
Oh yeah. I mean, what was it? I saw some stand-up show at like Madison Square Garden, and it was like, there's like thousands of people and the stage is in the middle. I'd be like, oh my God, they're everywhere. Like, you get to a point, I think there's enough people. Like, it's so intense.
By the way, when it's about improv, at some point it becomes so big, it actually makes your job harder.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. How much can you connect with a million people in a room? It's tough.
Exactly. It's tough. Yeah.
So yeah, tell me about your experience running this space. I mean, like, running a theater is not an easy thing to do. There's so many hats you have to wear, from like community leader to teacher, mentor, to boss, like organizer. How are you navigating it all?
I had to learn how to teach while I was still a student, which was a funny situation.
Yeah, I did that together. Too. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened was, originally, so our founder, I was one of the original members, but I wasn't the founder of the group, so to speak. I'm a founding member. It was a guy called Case DeFries, a very wonderful guy, still my co-teacher. He was a little bit older than us. And he, essentially, while we were all these bachelor students and all that, he got it up and running. And then right as he created the group, he went, right, now I have to do a PhD in another country. So he left. And someone had kind of take up the hat of starting our trainings and what have you not. And I went, well, I guess, you know, someone has to do it. I'll do it. And it was a weird scenario because I had to kind of learn as I went, because we didn't have an existing community that I could learn from or what have you not. So you would spend time, you know, traveling, getting master classes and reading lots of books and figuring it out. And I always say to my students, like, listen, you do in 10 weeks what took me 3 years, because I had no training at all. And then slowly as I went, more and more hats started, you know, I started putting on more hats. From that training, the group, it became more natural to train people that I didn't know, who were maybe a little bit more of a beginner. And I was like, all right, there's a difference between training and teaching. But then you figure that out. I think the only problem has always been that if you're always in that role, it's sometimes very difficult maybe to feel, it sometimes feels a little lonely, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But it's great. I mean, it's very rewarding. And the fact that so many people kind of, you can make a difference, that's amazing.
Yeah, it can be tough when you're the person who's, you know, giving the wisdom when you might maybe yourself need some wisdom. Like, yeah, if times are tough and you're looking for some shoulder to cry on, but turns out you're, you know, dad to everybody around, they're not offering you their shoulder. They're like, don't you know everything? And you're like, I don't.
That's exactly right. I mean, you, I think you interviewed on this podcast once, you interviewed Ari Vitalar from Oslo, right?
Yeah.
And he called it grandfather syndrome. I like that.
Yeah, that's certainly something that'll happen. You know, you're isolated, you're on your own. Everyone considers you, they care about you, they think you're the best, but it's real tough when you're like, but who do I talk to?
Travels upwards. So at some point, yeah. Yeah, it's all right. But, you know, that's if you can call that a downside at all, it's barely one. I mean, but that's definitely been one of the challenges in having all these hats, is that they have that in common. They have that kind of distance, I guess is a good word for it, in common.
You know what, though? let me just say that I actually think, though, acknowledging and trying to process the loneliness is an important thing. Because for leaders, especially leaders who are nurturing leaders, and in the case of a theater and a community, you aren't just like a boss who's like, this is what's happening. This is the way we make money. It's
no, yeah, you're a facilitator.
But you're also nurturing. You're like talking to people about their lives, and you're like caring for them, and they like call, and I don't know about you, but when I was running the conservatory at the theater I worked at, people would call me late in the night and like ask me for life advice, and like it was like all sorts of stuff. Like it was very like, you know, full on having to take care of them. So if you're doing that, how are you taking care of yourself? So I'm just saying, like, even though, yes, being lonely at the top is a silly problem to have, it's still something you want to, you like, take care of yourself. At least maybe even have an online community of other people who run things to be like, oh my God, they're killing me. Please someone tell me I'm not alone. And they're like, me too. I'm in Omaha. They're crazy. Whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so Arivitsala. So the thing is, Ari used to live here in this city years and years ago. And we still keep in touch, and we do exactly what you just said, which is we message with each other talking about stuff like this because we know what it's like.
That's really great.
But it's so true what you said about that students tend to go a little fall on sometimes, very rarely, but it's a big community where they, I think, because when you work in the arts, you work in the humanities, which also means, you know, there are these human qualities to everything that you do, and there's emotions involved and what have you not. And so sometimes it blurs a little bit between what's performance, what's the art, and what are the, let's say, personal issues kind of underlying problems that inform that performance. And then before you know it, they start talking to you about just those problems, and you think to yourself, I'm not even sure if I'm qualified at this point. Like, our conversation just moved from your performance to very personal issues underlying them, and I am not sure if, I mean, I think that's a healthy thought to have, because as long as you are worried about that, then I guess you're still being careful.
Yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, and you want to make sure that you're not giving bad advice, because, I mean, Lord knows the minute you're, the first time you do, it'll go everywhere. And they're like, how dare he said this? And you're like, I literally was trying to be nice.
They did it to me when I was a kid, you know?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. When I was like 15 or 16 and I was in a theater school, some of the teachers were like that. They would like give advice that, well, you're so vulnerable and it can really screw you up. So it made me really worried when I got into that position.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm thinking about the young children that I'm teaching. I'm like, what am I saying to them?
I bet you're very nice. We had a few people that were more about the art than any problems underneath. But when you're 15 and you're a boy or a girl, it doesn't really matter. Life is tough. And anything they say you think is the truth is the gospel. And it's tricky sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, they're funny. Well, I'm teaching comedy classes, so a lot of times I'm like, what's the weirdest thing you can think of? Go. And so it's not really time for sadness.
When I'm, what is like, the weirdest thing that they think of at that age?
I mean, usually it's like, I have an exercise where I'll have them brainstorm weird things to be afraid of, or like one of them was like, I'm afraid of burritos. And we had a long talk about that, which I thought was fun. And then we were like, okay. And then we use those weird things to kind of like flesh out, you know, comedy paths. So I'm like, okay, if you're afraid of burritos, what are other things that you're afraid of? And then we go through that. And then it helps me to get their minds ready for the idea of like building absurd comedy and that kind of stuff.
Did you ever ask them if they were afraid of tacos?
No, but we'll definitely put that one in. I'll bring it up next class.
I wonder where the limit is, right?
Yeah,
if they say like, no, I'm not afraid of tacos. Like, all right, so yes, burritos, no to tacos. And you want it. You're just using that to inform the scene, but before you know it, you're like psychoanalyzing them. Like, there's a limit there somewhere. What is it that makes you afraid?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we were writing this scene about this guy who drinks water, and the joke is that everyone else thinks that drinking water is terrible. So they're like, what are you doing? That's super gross. And I'm like, okay, great. What's weird about this? So we're like trying to find the joke, and it's just funny to like pull ideas out from them. And some of them where you're like, no, I don't. That's maybe too weird. Okay, all right, let's go to the next thing. Like, it's just super funny. Like, I love these ideas. This is what they pitch to me. I let them write their own sketches. Once I give them the framework, I'm like, all right, what do you want to write about? And I'm like,
how old are these kids?
14, 15.
There's something about 12. Both in acting and in improv. There's something about the younger the kids are, the more, what's the word in English? Precocious?
Sure. That's a word in English, yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
This no, idea it means that, what you mean.
I'm
sorry.
I'm not using it right. This idea that they have this kind of access, especially young kids, have this kind of access to the stuff that we as adults find difficult to reach, like free flow and creativity, et cetera. It's fascinating.
Yeah, they do have a freedom that, you know, we don't have. But, you know, I've been teaching recently different age groups. So I teach like a group that's like 12 to 14, and then I'll teach like 15 to 18. And I notice that when they get a little older, you know, when they're like teens and like things are really tough, then they're a little more solemn. And the topics they want to talk about are a little heavier. Whereas the younger kids are fine for total absurdity. I'm like, great, so we all have horns on our noses. What does that mean for the world? Like, and they're fine with that, you know? So it's interesting when I teach the different, because I teach the same comedy camp to two different age groups, and the end result is so different. And it is so funny to see how they communicate what they're going through in these kinds of things. I'm like, okay, sure. Everyone wants to fall? Great. Tons of pratfalls. Let's do it. Like, what do you guys think is the funniest thing?
You know what kind of people, a lot of people that sign up for our courses, PhD students.
Well, I don't know about 14-year-old ones, but maybe.
No, not 14-year-old PhD students. But I was thinking of this. No, but this idea of what you just said about older, the older they get, the more solemn they can get, especially in a difficult teen period.
Oh, I sure.
For students, they get some students get a little bit locked up inside their own heads, and I think none more so than PhD students who spend years specializing in one topic. And you know, at the beginning of the class, you talk to some people and go like, "What is it that you want to do? You know, do you ever see yourself getting on stage? You want to perform maybe for a living, or you know, do you just like doing this?" And most of these PhD students go like, "I just want to get out of my own head, man."
Man, it must be tough, though, by the time you get to be a PhD student, the level of oppression from academia must be so intense. Like, you know, I have a baby who's 2.5, and I'm like mentally preparing myself to put him into regular school purely with the idea that it's like this sort of like, keep yourself organized forever. Keep yourself in this box and do this thing that we tell you to do. And that's a lesson that I guess you want to learn and is important for life, I guess. But I find that people that end up getting all the way to PhD, they're so forced in these little boxes so much that you're right. By the time they get to the end of it, they're like, what's happening in the world? You know, how can I navigate now? What happens out there? And you're like, it's crazy out there. Watch out.
And trying to be correct all of the time, not in the kind of like smart aleck kind of way, but just like, you know, trying to give the correct answer, trying to do well. You
as
know,
in
improv, you don't need something good to start with. You just need something and then you make it good.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I just said that as if there is a correct answer, like there's nothing, anything is fine. I'm like,
you know,
that
exercise, I don't know if you have the same name for it. We call it what's in the box, where they kind of do a free association where they can pull anything out of a box. They have to do that really quickly, essentially. So the other person constantly goes, what's in the box? What's in the box? Like Brad Pitt in that movie, Seven.
Yes.
And then they really quickly have to go, you know, whatever, keyboard, George Clooney sunglasses, IKEA collection, communism, just yell these random words. And beforehand, we always tell them, hey, guys, by the way, there's no wrong answer. Like, whatever's in the box is fine. And yet people stumble all the time because their brain is constantly going, needs to be good, needs to be correct. And these young kids don't have that yet. They'll give it a go, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I find too that different people at different points in their life will gravitate towards improv, and that largely I deal with mostly people in their 20s, but I think that's just because they're in the journey of finding a community, finding an adult community that they can hang out with, and a sort of way of looking at the world and living that is different from their parents, but you know, gives them sort of a positive upswing. You know, I mean, because improv is sort of at least here, I don't know, maybe it's not there. And with you creating it sort of from all the different workshops that you learned, maybe it's not this way, but here it's a little, the yes and part is very enthusiastic. It's like, yay, everything's great. Let's do it. Super fun. And people make fun of us a lot. There's a lot of that. Yeah. You know, like, oh God, they're so enthusiastic. But I love the enthusiasm and I am into it. So I don't know. I mean, what do you guys do? What's the vibe that you're putting out? Is it great enthusiasm? How are you interacting with your community?
I mean, that's a great question, but I think it has two levels. I think, first of all, the enthusiasm towards saying yes to ideas in general is a thing that I miss about America. It's this thing that I really love this, especially, and it's very prevalent. It's more prevalent, I think, in the States than it is in Europe. This idea of, you know what, you do you, go ahead, try and aim for it, try and do it, you know. And it's a sense of positivity that I try to imbue a little bit over here, but culturally, I think just in the north of Europe, at least, it's not maybe as prevalent. People are just a little bit more shy, a little bit more, not careful, but just this idea of, no, I don't know if I should do it, very trying to consider all the options and whatever, you know. And it's this optimism that I miss whenever I visit the States. I love it. On the other hand, I do try to put it in classes, and mostly it just feels like putting in energy in the sense of to get a good vibe going, make people feel comfortable, heard, connected with, and I laugh really loudly when people are playing, and some students have asked me throughout the years, like, do you do that on purpose to kind of like get us going? I'm like, no, I'm blessed with actually just laughing at a lot of stuff and laughing really loudly. It's not fake, but it does help. It makes people feel at ease.
It really does. I feel like that's like the test of a good, like, level one teacher is, it's like, do you laugh loud and warmly? You're in. Like,
oh, yeah. That's a great point. You know, that's funny that you say that as a level one teacher, is that someone once said, hey, you know, if we ever make this into a whole school, let's say that it has like six levels and we have our own, you know, a massive building to ourselves, let's say you were there from the start, what would you pick? You know, you get to pick anything. I was like, level one, give me level one. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah, that's almost,
it's like I have some colleagues that are like, oh, not me, no, I would never do that. It depends on the kind of person you are.
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people are real snobby about level one. They think that you talk to somebody who's been doing it for a long time and you're going to get like a better response. I'm like, no, they have all these rules in their head and they're going to get all weird and like tell me mm-hmm. how to do it. Nah. Mm-hmm. No, thanks. I'm a control freak. I'll do level one.
It's that old biblical thing, right? Give me a child up to the age of seven, which is the idea that in their formative years, that's when you want them. That's when you can train people to have good, positive, open responses to things.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the idea of yes and in life. Like, you're right. And, you know, it's funny. It's both fascinating to me that you, like, did American studies. I'm like, what is that even? I don't even know what that would be. Like, it's like they talk to you about like Coca-Cola and JFK. Like, I don't know what that's about.
No, like, it's kind of this multidisciplinary program where they teach you about, so they got a professor from the history department teaching you about American history. They got a professor from the law department teaching you about American constitutional law. They got someone coming from cultural studies talking to you about, you know, cultural studies related to the States, things like that. So it's actually fascinating. The funniest part is that there are Americans in my class.
Oh, yeah? Do they, like, call people on it? They're like, no, we don't do that.
Yeah, occasionally. And then, you know, we're all like, why did you? It's fine. Whatever.
That's super funny. You're like, oh, that's so American of you to say.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that, but I loved it. And I miss it. I miss that attitude, the yes and attitude. Of course, the idea in yes and in improv is often misunderstood by people, where people think that it means that you have to say, that you cannot say no. I was like, of course you can say no. You have to just say yes to the idea. Like, if someone asks you to marry them in a scene, you can say, no, I don't want to marry you, as long as you acknowledge that there was a reason that they asked you in the first place, that was something that was happening. You know, a lot of beginner students are like, I can never say no. It's like, of course you can, but you just, we accept each other's ideas, which is a different thing.
Totally. I'm always like, if someone says, I like cookies, you're allowed to say, I don't like cookies. Like, that's fine. You acknowledged cookies is a thing. You're still in the room with them.
Like, no, you don't like cookies.
Or you say, like, what's a cookie? Like, get out of here. Come on. All right. Yeah. You know what a cookie is.
You know what? You're scared of tacos. That's what you are.
That's a whole crazy scene start. You're like, what is happening? Are you scared of tacos?
But it's interesting. But I read this once that you know, everyone always talks about the yes and idea of improv, which is true. It's a very important part. But someone, and I don't remember who, said that another very important part is that improv teaches you very well how to try and get inside the mind of someone who doesn't think like you, which is also a really great experience.
Yeah, I've been talking about this a lot lately. This is totally my jam. My jam lately has been to talk about empathy, because I really think that improv is this gateway into empathy, and that the high-minded ideal of an artist is to actually try your hardest to understand, or at least try to like look at the way, the perspective of as many people as you possibly can. And because there's so many different ways of looking at the world, and there's so many different experiences, like literally even just hearing you talk about that people are like studying America, like it's like, what? Like, why? Stop it. Don't. Ugh. You're just making our heads bigger. It's terrible. Like, but then, you know, it's like, that's just my point of view. And, you know, you're in your point of, I just love it. You know, that's our job as artists, is to like talk to people and understand and be like, what? That's the way you live your life? That's so awesome. This is the way I live mine. Like, it's so different, but it's working. We're doing
it. I'll give you a good reason to study America. America is the only modern Western nation that's new enough that we got to look inside the kitchen as it was made.
Yeah,
that's a great
true.
Reason to study, I think.
Yeah. Wouldn't we have wanted to see what caused the fall of Rome? I get it.
No, but it's true. And I feel, you know, what you say about improv and kind of as a gateway to empathy, I really like that. And it's also this philosophy of, I think a lot of people think of yes and in a kind of like yes man kind of way of living your life, is jump into new ideas, you know, engage in new situations. And that's true, but it's also a very individualistic way of approaching it. Improv ultimately is about making the other person in your scene look good. And if they do the same thing to you, right, you both look good. It's inherently, it is an art of connection. And I feel that, you know, when empathy is involved, that's the greatest training you can have in real life. It's not even that I say yes to so many more situations, is that hopefully I got better at listening and I got better at connecting and withholding judgment. I feel that's the greatest tools that it has given me.
Yeah, I can only hope that is really the case for everybody. I know there's lots of different schools and lots of different styles all around the world, but one would hope that at the end of the day, even the more like rough and tumble, like joke kind of crowds still have a warmth and an understanding of, you know, the way to communicate by listening, by even communicating without words, the full experience of improv being like all five senses engaged, well, maybe four, for the experience in that moment.
Do you like that? Are you into that kind of joking at someone, not joking with someone thing? Is it a thing that you like?
No, I mean, I would say that like there's different styles of improv like in the US that are, you know, talked about, and you know, some of them are more famous in a way that then makes people want to do things in a certain style. And what's funny is, okay, so like I'm talking about UCB, and like they're very jokey, right? But I had this preconceived notion of the way that it was, because I've known a few people that took classes there, and most people who, and I have not, but most people will say, oh, well, the stuff that we're doing is a little bit more, you know, a little slower and a little bit more about developing a character and living in the world than it is about going from joke. And I was like, oh, okay, well, what's the joke one? And they're like, oh, UCB does that. But a couple of months ago, I interviewed one of the teachers at UCB, and I was like, tell me everything. The word on the street is UCB teaches this. Is it true? And he was was like, no, I don't think so at all. So, you know, I feel like the idea of what one group is doing, or like, because some people will say, I like it slower, I like it faster. And I'm down for every group to perform whatever way that they want to. You know, sure. Like people like to do the Herald to give them a structure. I have never done a Herald in the way that it makes me feel like I have a handle on it. Like I'm always like, sure, let's do it. And I like jump on the roller coaster, but I don't know what's happening because I'm not that tight in my performance in that way. You know, everybody has a different style. And I think that sometimes there are people who are trying to make jokes just to make jokes in the moment. But I feel like that actually hurts improv. So most theaters are weeding them out.
I think that's kind of a mischaracterization. I agree with the UCB teacher. I think there's a mischaracterization of what UCB does. Because in that way, you could also describe Stranger Things Have Happened, which is my group, as in that way. But it's not really, because either a joke is jokey in the sense that it's meta, or it comes from a place of I'm just trying to get a joke in, versus it's witty and it just comes from whatever the game of the scene is or whatever the character would say anyway, where you're like, oh, it makes total sense that character would say that. And then suddenly it's really, really funny, and there's nothing wrong with that. As long as it's organic, it's integrated.
I mean, you can be funny. All of it. I mean, 90% of the people signing up for improv classes are funny. I usually say that on the first day of level one. I go, okay, the first thing people always say to me in comedy classes is, I'm afraid I don't know how to be funny. You signed up for this class. You're funny. Like, either you or your friend acknowledged that you're a funny person and they told you to go to a comedy theater. You didn't walk in because you were dull. Come on. So first,
But I think the fear is that they think that we're going to point at them and go like, all right, you say something funny. And it's like, that doesn't work. But it's like, no, we're going to create a space for you so that it feels organic and you can be reactive in the way that, let's say you're in a pub with your friends, you're sitting around the table and, you know, the mood's good. And then people start kind of messing around a little bit. And all of a sudden, everything is hilarious. That's the space you want to go for. So you don't feel pressured at all. It's just natural.
Yeah, it's like bits. You know, like doing bits with your friends, like one night you're out and then all of a sudden everyone's making references to a banana phone. And then anytime somebody says banana or phone, everyone laughs. And like, you know, it's like a whole thing that continues throughout with you and your friends. Like that's the stuff that leads you into improv. And then once the beauty of people working in troops together for a long time is that comfortability. Is that like you, even when you're on stage with each other, it's like you're relaxed and having a nice time at the pub. You're right. Like, because these are your friends and you're connected.
Does that ever drive you crazy? That kind of pattern recognition?
No, I'm a big fan of pattern recognition.
No, I don't mean an improv. I mean for yourself.
No, I'm very self-reflective personally, and the more I can analyze myself, the better I am. Like if I know or at least feel good about what I'm doing, then I'm always like into it. So I spend a lot of time watching the way things work because also I'm a teacher. So it's like I exist in the world, but whenever I'm existing in it, I am also thinking like about teaching. And a lot of times I'll find new ways to communicate stuff purely just through conversations. Like, honest to goodness, these interviews that I do help me teaching so much because I get to really deep dive talk about these topics. And then I get to go in with whatever I've learned from you. And the next time I teach my improv class, I'm like, all right, guys, listen to this. This is what we're doing, you know?
That's what I found out. Yeah, absolutely. No, I sometimes do wonder. I talked about this recently with like another improv player, where I thought I wonder if I have more trouble going back to bed in the mornings now that I've been doing improv for so long, because it always feels like when you play a lot, like a couple of times a week, then your mind is used to that state of kind of racing a little bit, of going quite fast to try to identify whatever it is that's going on. And I have this feeling that now in the morning when I wake up, and then normally there's that moment where you go back to sleep because, you know, well, not you because you have a kid, but like...
Yeah, I was like, what's that?
Yeah, exactly. But like for me, because I don't have a kid, I used to be able to kind of go back to sleep, but now my mind just starts racing, not worries, but just like very quick associations in my mind. And I thought, what if this is the dark side of, you know, training this stuff for the stage, is that I just can't shut it up anymore. I wonder if other people feel that.
You know what? I actually think that is like, it's sort of like a mind that is primed to be doing stuff. Like, if you're ready and you've got the creative juices flowing, don't fight it. If they're coming, let them come. There are definitely going to be times when you're going to wake up and the thought in your head is just going to be like, don't forget to pay the electricity bill. And that stinks. Like, you don't want that to be your first thought. But if your first couple thoughts are like, but what if we did this? If I bought that wig that I saw, it would really make this character better. Then I could get this slot in this other place. You know, like, whatever, if your brain is teeming with creative ideas, I think it's nothing but good. And I think
how do I really feel about these tacos?
Yeah. What can I do? What different ways can I serve tacos? Even though that's the only meal I will serve to my family and friends at all times.
What about tacos now? Yeah.
Man, you joke, but I live in Austin, Texas. Every meal is a taco. Like,
I really
not
visit
kidding.
Austin, Texas. I've been to Austin, Texas,
oh,
I think.
Please, but come visit.
No, I wasn't. You guys have... There's an airport in Austin, Texas, right?
Oh, yeah, we got an airport. We got an international airport. I bet you can fly right in.
I did. I think that's why I'm so hesitant about it. I think I flew in once and then had to leave like an hour later. But technically, I inhaled your air.
What? Do you want to tell that story that you're talking about in the airport for 1 hour?
The security guard was cool and let me out for a moment to stand in the sun right outside, and then I went back in. It's a very boring story.
But why? Why did you fly and then leave?
No, I didn't. I didn't go back to Europe. I was on my way to the West Coast.
I'm like, dude, wait. Why are you flying so far for 1 hour in an airport?
I would love you so much that I would fly all the way there for an hour of your air and then go back to Europe.
Like, what is happening?
No.
Dude, you're weirdly addicted to American studies. You just breathing in air. You're like, I got it now, guys. You go back, you walk into your American studies class. You're like, I bet you didn't do what I did over the weekend. Yeah. Okay.
It might have cost me 400 euros, but man, it was worth it.
Oh my God, you'd be lucky if that's all it cost. Oh my God, that's so funny. Well, good. At least you were going somewhere else. Gee, Belugas.
That's a good scene, though. Like a tourist that just flies to the airport but doesn't have time to do anything else.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I was afraid it was worse. I was afraid what? You got there and they were like, nope. Out, get back. We're a terrible place. It's that happens to a lot of people. I don't know.
Does it? Does it happen to anyone?
I'm sure it does. Yeah.
Weren't they supposed to check at the airport disembarking?
It's sweet that you think we care what other people are doing.
No, well, you're really selling it to me.
Yeah, it's okay. You can come. I bet you they let you. They let you in before. Your name's on a list of cool Europeans. It's okay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's fine.
How long is that list?
It's a long list, but you know, but it's okay because you're on it, so it's all right. Nice. They'll let you in. A security guard let you breathe the air. That's pretty legit.
Oh man. I just love this idea of just flying back. I'm like, well, this is great.
No, I just thought it was such a weird... Oh, yeah. See, that's what happens when your brain is wacky, right? You immediately go to the most absurd, but what's the most absurd thing that this could have mean?
Our improv group is called Stranger Things Have Happened. And it, by the way, listeners, it predates the Netflix show. But the reason that it's called that way is simply because, you know, this is a crazy story, right, that you and I just discussed. But you can bet that it happened to someone.
Yeah.
That's what the name means, you know? Like, it doesn't really matter what you think of. Somewhere in life, things have been stranger than that, for sure.
Oh, my God, that's so funny. You know, that's how I teach three beats. Like, that's how I teach heightening of a comedy theme, like in a scene. So it's like make it crazier and crazier. So I'm like, okay, the first example you throw out, regular world, it can happen, totally fine. He doesn't want to eat a taco. What's the next thing that it could be? It's something that's crazy enough that you'd probably want to Google it to make sure it was true, but you have a 50% chance that it's true. So it's like, this guy married a taco. What? Yep, happened. Illinois, 1983. And you're like, what? So you Google it and you're like, no, okay, it didn't happen. Phew. But then the third beat is couldn't happen, no way. There's no Google in the world that's going to make this true. Or it's like, you know what? Turns out moon actually made out of tacos, not cheese. So that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, so that's how I'll do it. So I love that, like, your show is built around, you know, sort of that absurd creation of a story that's like wild. Now, do you get people to tell real stories that are fantastical, or is that what you guys do in your show? You create a narrative of a story that maybe could be true, but probably isn't.
The last one, for sure. I really love the edge of, you know what, this actually, either it happened somewhere or it could possibly happen. I love that little edge right there. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, the world is weird enough that anything is true. Feel free to take this assumption I made about you traveling for 1 hour to Austin.
It must have happened, and on purpose, too. I'm sure someone did it. What? Just to be the guy or girl to say, I did that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. One would hope that they'd leave for a minute, though, to get a taco and get back, you know, just to follow the pattern. But,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, those people went past, like, surely you got a taco. And they went, like, no, I didn't do that because I knew you would ask me that question. And I don't want to be predictable. Yeah.
I don't want to be predictable. Listen, I buy plane tickets to nowhere. It's fine. Oh, my God. That's so funny.
I didn't know where I was. You know, someone yelled Austin on the way back home.
It seems likely. Woo!
Yeah.
Yep.
Woo!
We're a woo Austin crowd. Sure. So tell me, sort of wrapping it up, tell me what is sort of the big lesson that you are working on right now? Like earlier, I said my jam was empathy. What's your jam? What's the like lesson or the thing that you've been focused on in your teaching or your show that's sort of creatively rattling around in your brain?
I like this. So maybe not so much in the teaching part of it, but more in the show part of it. I've been playing recently also at festivals, these kind of small, with smaller groups, which are like subgroups of our big improv groups. So these 2-man shows, sometimes these 3-man shows. And I love this idea of making really big choices at the start of something and then trying to work your way towards it. I was like, I work with this guy, amazing guy. He's now an improviser in Amsterdam. His name is Chad Bullock. He's American. He's from Mississippi, not Texas, but, and
He's legit.
And the man is very legit too. And at the he would you know have these crazy things at the beginning of a scene that makes you think, how are we gonna justify this, right? How are we gonna ground this? How are we gonna make this feel real? And that's my favorite thing ever. Basically, I like this idea of being able to justify anything in terms of anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're good enough at it. And I adore that. And I want to do more shows with people who kind of on the surface seem like they're knocking that ball way too far out of the park. And then going like, let's see how fast we can get this back to base. Let's see how quickly we can ground this and make it something that people can not only really laugh at the absurdity, but actually connect to at the same time. You know, so I love that idea. I love it.
Yeah. That also provides such a solid contrast for the audience to enjoy through that comedy. The absurdity and then the grounding it in sort of real life situations. It's like,
I did this recent show with him where it's like these are essentially mono scenes, right? And this was one that was a show of about an hour stuck between two peaks of the Tibetan mountains where a bunch of reporters flew in to kind of try and document a Yeti, but the Yeti befriends and then falls in love with one of the reporters, and the whole shtick for the hour is them flying back to the Yeti tent and then back to regroup at the base to talk about what's happening, and then back to the Yeti, and then back constantly with his little helicopter. It's the stupidest thing ever, and yet afterwards I kept receiving messages about that show. You know what I mean? There's something so tickling about absurdity mixed with, you know, what somehow still feel like authentic characters. There's something really nice about that.
I think that's really great too for your students as well. I know you were thinking of it in your own performance wise, but even just the allowing of absurdity or helping them find a way to sort of like let some crazy thing that happened be what the scene's about. A lot of times people will reject something super crazy that happens in their scene, you know, and not in a no kind of way, but so much in the way that they're like, well, I don't know how to juggle that. You know, so
juggle anything.
The more you work on it, the better you'll be at helping your students navigate it. That's really, really great.
Yeah. And you know, it really, it increases this sense of fun, because some people, I think, play authenticity, not authenticity, you should always play authentic, but I mean, like, realistically, just try to keep scenarios as realistic as possible as a kind of safety thing. And also, in that sense, you know, never fully discover the full extent of fun, of the fun they could be having if they got a little wilder, because don't worry, you're in control. Trust it. Move with it.
Yeah, right. It's just you talking. Nothing else crazy can happen. You're all right.
Yeah.
So fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with me and talking to me about everything. It's been really great to hear, you know, about your experience and, you know, your school and the way that you're developing it. You seem to have a really great attitude about the whole experience. And I thank you so much for sharing your stories with me.
Thank you very much for what I thought was a very nice conversation. Thank you.
Oh, you're very kind.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.